it happens on a Friday or a Thursday for a long weekend every month or so.
It's bad luck. And, you know, I it's very bad luck for Pat.
I feel awful for him.
Karma sucks.
I feel terrible. Yeah, just awful.
So, yeah, we're going to find out, I guess. And we might not even get a decision on Tuesday. You know, the judge may take some time to think about what the outcome will be. But, yeah, that's where we're at with Pat King. And he's been in jail this whole time.
I lost some weight. He's been dropping some pounds while he's in there.
Did he lose weight?
Did he lose his leg?
Two questions. Does he have cornrows yet, or is that in June?
I heard that it was a shaved head and a braid.
Shaved head and a braid. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And does he have a leg to stand on?
Stop it. Stop it. Grow up.
What?
Don't. Please don't grow up.
What? What?
You pirated what? That
or,
joke.
Or is he going out on one limb? I mean.
Stop parroting things and don't pirate jokes. That's not, it's not good. Me hardy.
I had him pegged as getting out soon. Oh.
You're good at this. You're better than me.
Too good. You're too good at that, actually.
Yeah.
Does he really have one leg? Yes. Because I haven't seen him. Like,
oh, he does? I don't know. I was just vamping. I had no idea.
Yes. Actually, he has a video where he takes off his leg and shakes it at the camera, and he's yelling at Jagmeet Singh.
Why do I want that video so bad right now in my life?
Apparently, he lost it because of diabetes or whatever or something. But he tells everybody it was in the war, which he never was part of. That's what I've heard.
War for freedom.
Yeah, he tells people he lost in Afghanistan. You know, when we get to this part of the conversation where we take great joy in other bad people suffering, I always look down at Karima's face and she's like this.
She's trying for that, though.
She's like this. Yeah. Gentlemen, please. Yeah. I'm a lawyer.
It's not that I'm a lawyer. I'm just a good person.
Yeah, you are. Fucking
You're way better than the three of us.
Welcome to the corner of Hunter George. This is episode 14. Corner of Hunter George you can find on Spotify and Apple. I'm too lazy to put it on SoundCloud at the moment, but you know, that's not such a disturbing reason as really I've lazily, neglectfully not improved my microphone. I know you can hear the buzz. It's an awful thing I've been living with, and I plan to improve this soon. I'm going to get on that this upcoming week. Well, in this episode, you're going to hear me speaking to Karima Zai. Hard to define in a few words, and I'm not going to do it right here, but she's someone who has been present at such events as you'll hear the Ottawa Convoy, Petersburgers, and here in town. This is the Peterborough Connection, even though she is by practice in some ways a lawyer from Toronto. And I'll say right now a few things that came up during my interview with her that I neglected or didn't get to. I did not talk to her about Justin Trudeau, in particular his 2022 version of the War Measures Act. There were some doggy interruptions. Understandable. Always understanding of those. And I maybe should have included their barks in there. But you may get certain slight barks, but I didn't leave in the full barking in that. And also my mispronunciations of her name. So you have every right to be lambasting me right now about that. Anyway, in this discussion I had with her, we'll go from such things as you were hearing there at the beginning, that was Dean Blundell, his show where she was on, and they were lambasting Pat King, I think in some ways in poor taste, and you could hear at the end there that Karima was not joining that congregation of male inferiority about Pat King. you know, there's a line to draw somewhere. And we'll talk about her Ottawa Peterborough experiences, her attempts at interviewing Chris Skye last year in July, her overall ambitions and purpose, and how throughout this whole thing it really is a matter of the questions we're asking, not the answers we're giving. So here's my interview. It was just done this past week on April 14th, 2022 with Karima Zai.
Okay, so my name is Karima Saad. I am a lawyer, and I also use art and comedy to try and convey my political opinions, let's say, as a form of expression. And so it results in different forms of advocacy. I do the traditional sort of lawyering in a courtroom. And I've also branched out into political comics or sort of editorial cartoons, parody songs, skits. And I do a lot of documenting at anti-vax rallies and other events of interest, but I am particularly focused on COVID denialism. So that's kind of the scope of what I do. And, you know, the purpose really is to generate thoughtful discussion, and sort of the thoughtfulness of discussion that gets generated, that's a hit or miss. But certainly there's a lot of issues that are polarizing, and I like to dip my toe into those and see sort of what we can pull out from it. And sometimes there is growth that can happen there in that space.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely an interesting way to come at it. And would you call yourself sort of a citizen journalist? I know that term has been applied to you with what you've done.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's a, I didn't go to school for journalism, so I'm not mm-hmm. a professional journalist. I've used the term gonzo journalist at times, because while I started off being much more of a fly on the wall, at some point I was thrust into the story itself. And I kind of leaned into that. So I can't say that everything I capture is entirely objective, because parts of it center on my own experience and interactions with people in the crowd and so on. That's, I think that that's the descriptor I would use.
Okay. Yeah. I sometimes wonder what exactly that term means in itself. I mean, I guess when you're saying gonzo, I have a bit of a guess of an understanding, like in a Hunter Thompson kind of sense. But I guess when you're saying that what's got you into what you've done lately a lot of is the whatever we want to call them, anti-vaxxers, the convoy, whatever, is it because, like, for me, it, like, if you're taking them at face value, dangerous perhaps use the word them, but the general messages you're getting are kind of head scratching in a logistical, if we want to have thoughtful conversation, and I've seen you attempt to have ones with people like Chris Sky, is very head scratching, and there must be something deeper underneath. Is there something to what I'm saying there?
Yeah, I like what draws me, I think, to the movement is the extent to which it's based on legal misinformation. Obviously there's scientific misunderstandings as well, all sorts of lack of knowledge or just grasp on how things work. But the law side is what I'm equipped to sort of unpack or deal with. You know, I've had mixed experiences as far as having conversations that are meaningful. And at times, I think the most meaningful conversations probably happen, you know, offline, off camera. But in engaging with people like Chris Sky, you know, I've been accused of platforming his ideas. But really what I seek to do is undermine them by sort of presenting an opposite side in a really tangible way, because I think that there is fairly widespread opposition that is diffused, and there isn't, you know, there's I guess people who maybe could be termed ultra-vaxxers, but there's not really a pro-vax movement. And so that, I think, and especially when it's portrayed in the media, it's a bit misleading, because there's a group that's organized and they show up every week. And I think it kind of like a blowfish, right? It gives a sense that they're a lot bigger than they actually are. So in trying to engage, right, it's partially, you know, for people in that camp, right? Like, that's part of the audience. But it's also people who are outside of that and just trying to make sense of, you know, what's going on, because head scratcher is a very apt descriptor.
Yeah. And when you're saying you're really interested in law, I besides obviously being a lawyer, but I also take it that you're somewhat also interested and how the police think and their either reaction or interaction with the convoy movement and things similar that you're talking about. Because I was watching your, not too long ago, your discussion with maybe Canada's last traditional journalist left, Steve Paikin, on a group there. And I was getting from that discussion that a lot of people were trying to lay out the problems with how they reacted in Ottawa. The police is kind of more a systematic kind of problem, and I think you were trying to point out how, like, on an individual level, it was quite common for the police to just simply kind of, you know, hold back everything and just let them come right into the Capitol and mm-hmm. just kind of, and that would be like almost like a commonality with how they thought, if not supporting, certainly did not feel like putting up any sort of front to them having a full out protest movement for a while, like, above protest movement, really, but that sort of thing. So I found that kind of interesting. So, like, I guess what I'm trying to get at with the police in general, like, I think it's dangerous to kind of want them to be taking a heavy hand, but overall, is there something from what either happened in Ottawa, maybe what you saw here on April 9th in Peterborough, or what you've seen overall of what they should be doing or what they perhaps should be thinking of differently, or is it kind of just kind of an unfixable problem?
Ooh, there's so much to unpack there. I mean, I guess I would start by saying that discretion plays a very important role in policing, and I'm not one to call for heavy-handed action. Part of my practice, although a relatively small part of my practice, is criminal defense. And so I've seen scenarios where police are in fact brutal and have no issue utilizing state violence against citizens. And I find that disturbing. And I think that that's not the type of society that we should be pushing for. So in a sort of ironic way, the response to convoy and related demonstrations or protests, you know, there's often good use of de-escalation or choosing to allow it to happen and charge after the fact, right? And kind of with a mind to protecting civilians. Although I think that the pendulum almost swings too far in that direction, where citizens who are not part of these events or protests feel that they actually aren't being protected adequately. So there's extremes on both ends. And sort of going back to this idea of discretion, you know, a lot of that happens at the front line, sort of an individual response, but like police are also just, there's a hierarchy. And so they have orders to behave in a particular way. And, you know, I've seen coordinated police efforts, for example, in taking down encampments in Toronto, where it's almost militant the way that it unfolds, you know, the level of precision, the resources that are used, the gear, all of that. So we know that police can do crowd control and they can make choices to shut things down. And so the fact that, and I was sitting in on the Peterborough Police Board meeting this week, and the acting chief, you know, was speaking to this issue, and really himself was emphasizing discretion and, you know, the importance of charter rights and allowing people free assembly and protest. And that is nice to hear, but practically speaking, police are the number one violators of charter rights. If you've ever sat in on criminal court, you know that all sorts of cases get tossed because very basic fundamental rights are not respected. So I have to take it with a little bit of a grain of salt. And, you know, I don't know exactly what the solution is. I think part of the problem is that there is a sympathy that police have towards this particular group of protesters. For what reason, it's unclear. Do they identify with the actual demonstrators themselves? Is it a demographic thing? Is it the actual core issue of, you know, being anti-vax or anti-government regulation? Hard to say. But there exists as well in like the opposite sort of sense, an antipathy towards other types of groups protesting. So I think that discrepancy is the real issue. And I don't know how that gets resolved without a major culture change. And certainly in Ottawa, and I was there on the ground for the duration of the convoy / occupation. And I saw all sorts of leniency that I don't think would be afforded in other circumstances, and really created distrust between residents and police. And, you know, I think ultimately what we're dealing with here are social issues. And I think it's a mistake to try and use the blunt force instrument of criminal law or policing to resolve this. You're not going to police people into changing their opinions. And so it being a social issue, I think that resources need to be put more in that direction and addressing sort of what brings people or what creates this discontent. How can that be resolved? How can we better utilize public resources? Because police largely, I think, have been ineffective at controlling this, and the money that is in their budgets might be better spent elsewhere.
Yes, yeah, I did hear you mention that on the agenda as well, that point too, which I totally agree. But if you're looking at, I guess, just a blunt reality, whether we like it or not, I don't. What happened in 2020, and ever since too, it seems like the traditional thing of like everything is cut at a municipal level except for policing and perhaps the fire department seems to be a tradition that's ongoing mm-hmm. in most Canadian places that I know of anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'll just take a brief swab or stab at other aspects of yourself. So at least before COVID, or at least this anti-vax movement came up as something you wanted to pursue, you were part of I don't know what all the letters stand for, sorry, but you're part of Normal Canada.
Yeah.
2020 to 2022, I believe. It's just recently you stepped down from being the head of that. Is that true?
Yeah, it was the executive director. It stands for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Okay. So it originated in the States, but now there are chapters all across the world. And in Canada, it's a national level organization. And sort of post legalization of cannabis, the real focus has been on equity in the cannabis market landscape, addressing sort of some of the historical legacies of prohibition and criminalization, and pushing for rules and policies that are fair and reasonable for both consumers and producers. So there's a lot of stigma that is still kind of wrapped up in cannabis and even in the way that portfolio is handled by Health Canada. So various forms of advocacy and trying to just, you know, push for a more open and fair landscape.
Right. And is it partly because your attention's directed elsewhere, or do you partly feel like with our reforms to our legislation, kind of you've achieved a lot of some of your tasks that you were meaning to when you first started out with that?
I mean, it's still like my association with the organization like hasn't concluded. Right. So we're still, you know, there's still stuff to work towards, you know, and court decisions to try and overcome. There's ongoing hurdles. So the fact that it's legal is obviously a huge and important step, but not the end of the story. And yeah, it is still part of what I do and I'm interested in.
Okay. Now another dimension of your life, I think an important one, because I think with this one, you go back quite a ways. I'm not sure exactly where the genesis of it is, but you're basically your artistic work, your cartoon work. You're probably the number one Doug Ford cartoonist that I know of. You're quite actually, in what I see of it, I'm not claiming to have seen them all. You're quite actually complimentary to him. You make him look a little more youthful. And I would argue he looks like he's lost 20 pounds in some of those depictions you have of him. But yes, that seems to be like a fascination of yours. So I don't know, is it just something, a skill that came to you naturally, and you just like a hobby or kind of a passion that you can't put down, just cartoon artwork in general, political cartoons?
I work with an illustrator to produce these. So my primary role is conceptualizing the pieces, doing the writing, figuring out the little Easter eggs, you know, and what's the point that we're trying to get across, and doing the write-up. So I am very fortunate to have talented people in my corner. I draw, but not stuff that I publish. Okay. So that's maybe where, you know, I'm a little bit shy to put my own work out there. But the reason for sort of the fascination about Doug Ford, it's funny. I went to school for, like, in my undergrad for international development. And so, you know, I always had kind of that global focus. And just the further I got in my career, the more I realized how important kind of provincial and municipal politics are. And so with my primary aspect of law being housing law, I'm constantly dealing with the province and sort of fallout from decisions or provincial legislation. And just Doug Ford is a very fascinating character, and just so much material there. And as far as portraying him, you know, we make artistic choices, and probably there are some low-hanging fruit that we could go for in depicting him. But I don't want that to detract from the message of the comics, and I am wary about leaning into certain tropes, right? So that's kind of why it's maybe a bit blunted compared to what we could actually do with him.
Yes. Okay. And were you someone who in the past had almost an equal fascination with his now deceased brother when he was mayor of Toronto?
I was tuned out of municipal politics at that time. So I came about my knowledge of Rob Ford sort of in the aftermath. And it was going back and reading articles, and just, it was totally just a mind trip. So I regret that I didn't experience it live to some extent, but I did have the benefit of hindsight. And so even like in reading Robin Doolittle's book about Rob Ford, you know, now 10 years later, after we have his brother as premier, it was just like, it was an interesting experience. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. As someone who remembers the fist fight Rob had at City Hall, I forget what date that was, but that was one of my, one of my wilder experiences. I was just, I at that time was in Toronto, and I was just in on that meeting. Just, I even forget what was being discussed, but anyway.
I was late to work because of his funeral. I remember that.
Yes. Okay. And I just, sorry, one more Ford family question. Is there been any depictions of, I forget what her name is, one of the daughter who's really...
Krista. Taken,
that's right, Krista. Has there been any depictions of her in any of these, the cartoon?
Yeah, yeah, I think, okay. I probably have maybe 5 or 6 comics about Krista. And there's a couple of comics about the other sister, Kyla, as well. She is the cookie maven of the family.
That's right. Yes.
So the family does pop up occasionally, and I get a bit of slack for it, right? Because, you know, family is supposed to be off limits for politicians. And I think that that is a fair rule generally. But the Fords are unique in the way that they approach politics and sort of treat themselves as a dynasty. And her views are, when we look at them in conjunction with the policies that Doug Ford has chosen to pursue, you know, I have a lot more questions than answers.
Yeah. There's a lot of things there to study. I'll just go on to maybe to what happened in Ottawa and your presence there, but I guess in a 2020 hindsight kind of way, do you feel they were in some ways successful, as in like being in the state where we are now, where it's, you know, no more mass mandates and things as such? Obviously we're still, you know, mm-hmm. even though our numbers now are higher than when school wasn't in place, I believe the last time in the spring of 2021. But do you feel like it was kind of a success for them?
I think that they will take more credit than they deserve mm-hmm. for these change in policies. You know, I believe, at least in Ontario, that the upcoming election has something to do with the decisions that were made. Ultimately, Doug Ford is a populist, and these were pretty unpopular mandates across the board. And, you know, the consequences of lifting the mandates are something that, for better or worse, can be buried by suppressing numbers and data. And the aftermath in the long term isn't going to be noticeable in the short term. So I think that, you know, engaging their success, right? Certainly they were able to capture the attention of the country. To that extent, you know, that there was probably progress made on that front. And whether that attention, you know, is going to result in more people joining their ranks or contempt from other residents. That remains to be seen. And that's, you know, in being in Ottawa and sort of having on the ground footage, I wanted to give the realest possible picture of what was going on, and people will ultimately come to their own conclusions.
Right. And one thing I find about the whole movement in general, and this isn't just what happened in Ottawa, this is what like was happening last summer. We certainly had a lot of them in Peterborough, these kind of one day weekend rallies they were having around our city hall with the same sort of message about getting rid of our mandates, or it was more centered actually on that time about just an anti-vaccination kind of message. But it was like people, you know, bringing their families out and these F you Trudeau signs and all that sort of thing. I always have found, I have not as not being daring enough to do what you're doing, not as a reporter, not trying to get myself on live online or something, but just, you know, just going to old fashioned observing, I found there to be a lot of times a noticeable presence of the People's Party or the Ontario Party for a provincial election. But I don't find that's often talked about enough. And I don't know, have you picked up anything from Ottawa or your other experiences that they sort of have, they're maybe not behind a lot of it, but they certainly are an important part of this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is a political presence, like a formal political presence that is an undercurrent. Politicians like Maxime Bernier and Randy Hillier come top of mind. There are others as well. And, you know, we currently have Pierre Poilievre running around the country, hosting his own rallies. And he's someone, I think, who has his feet on kind of both sides of that pond. And to people who are Convoy supporters, he is fairly adept, I believe, at messaging that resonates with them. And he's also able to lean on his lengthy political career for that respectability, kind of, you know, as much as he, you know, it's all relative, right? Yeah. But I think that, you know, the point that you've hit on is this idea of populism. And that's ultimately what the PPC is. You know, that's the rhetoric that Randy Hillier pushes. And it's what Pierre Poilievre is trying to do. And, you know, there's a danger there in that it inflames tensions. It sort of will cast groups or individuals as villains or easy targets, and offer easy solutions that in fact are... Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. That's okay. I've one myself who does that. So
I'll repeat that sentence if that's okay. It offers easy solutions that in fact are not going to be responsive to the actual complex problems that we're facing. And we live in a world of nuance. I'll wrap up that thought in the best way I can.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. So yes. Populist leaders will try to offer simple solutions to very complex problems. And we do live in a world of nuance, and it's very easy to make promises that can't be kept because they aren't actually responsive to the world that we live in. And people fall prey to that, especially in times of turbulence or where there is great fear and uncertainty. And so I think that that is a major risk. And as much as part of what I do is poke fun at or highlight absurdities or inconsistencies, it's a mistake to laugh this off entirely. And I think that humor has a role in identifying some of these, some of the hypocrisies or again, just discrepancies, inconsistencies. But we should not be dismissive.
No, and I do agree that laughing it off or being dismissive is actually quite dangerous for anyone to be doing. But that being said, yeah, I think there's something to be saying about a bunch of individuals who have seen this kind of as opportunity, how much their actual ideologies or beliefs are wrapped up into it is maybe secondary. So mm-hmm. if we're talking about people like, you know, Pat King or Tamara Lick or Chris Barber and so on, Randy Hillier, like you mentioned, is it fair to define them, like I've heard Ezra Levant called a lot of times, like, is it fair to define them as kind of charlatans, really? Like, they're kind of seeing an opportunity to make a name mm-hmm. for themselves media-wise, perhaps financially, going by GoFundMe. Mm-hmm. And this is really all that's what's driving them.
I think that there probably is an element of truth to that. And you know, it's maybe a bit cynical, but certainly I don't know how much any of the people you listed believe what they actually say. So you know, they've found a message that works for them in sort of gathering the audience and support that they want or are looking for. And you know, to the extent that religiosity plays a role in this, because it is a recurring theme, you know, that's where it's difficult to ascertain, does someone believe what they're putting out there, or is this for optics only? And I don't know the answer to that, but I think either way, it's a bit scary.
Yes. Well, yeah, I don't think there are any simple answers. And like you're saying, a lot of the point of this is asking questions on religion itself. Yeah, I would argue that is definitely a big part of at least what's been happening here in Peterborough, and probably through a lot of Canada's smaller cities or towns that have been behind this. And I think it makes me think of what I was hearing Jonathan Franzen interviewed in the fall, and he was kind of just about whatever book he has out now, but he was making the point in his interview about how, you know, if you're someone who's lived kind of upper middle class or never really had any financial challenges, you don't really need religion. But people who sort of, you like these underlying problems, social problems that we have in Canada, economic instabilities, that's maybe where like religion can be something to turn to. And in turn, it's not hard with social media to be connected to these social or these conspiracy theories at the same time, since mm-hmm. if they're being done mm-hmm. through your church or evangelical ministry or whatever. So I'm saying that as a possible theory anyway mm-hmm. of something. And I don't know, do you blame a lot of what happened in Ottawa and what has happened in Canada in the past year or so with regards to these anti-vax movements? Do you blame a lot of that on social media itself?
Social media definitely makes it easier for people to put themselves in silos. And I think that there's documented evidence to show that the algorithms will specifically boost content that generates outrage. And so that is inherently going to cause division and polarization. So I, you know, it's inescapable to connect what's going on to social media. And also the fact that the way that we receive information has fundamentally changed. And, you know, we now turn to our friends online who share an article, or an influencer we trust who puts something out there. And, you know, it's not gatekept in the same way that sort of traditional media institutions might have. And that presented its own set of problems. But where we're at right now, especially where there are entities deliberately poisoning the environment with untruths or misinformation, disinformation. You know, it's a crisis of knowledge, and how do we know what's real and what's not real? And so I think that that certainly, you know, has played a part in what we're seeing happen. And the fact that for a year and a half, 2 years, people were mostly staying at home and were isolated from, you know, in real life social circles, and found their own set of people online. So how do we undo that? I'm not sure how we sort of plan for deprogramming on a mass scale. We've never faced something like this as a society.
Yeah. And it's something that's is hard to see being done either. You know, I don't even know what the way is to say of it being done properly, but like any sort of like kind of censorship, I don't really like, you know, for use previous person you're talking about, Chris Sky, he's probably been, I don't know, he's probably been booted off Twitter probably about, or Instagram probably about mm-hmm. 9 times, but mm-hmm. I would argue that's probably not doing much to hurt his support or his followers or his fans.
No, in some ways it like he uses it to make himself a martyr, right? Like they need mm-hmm. to shut me down because I'm speaking the real truth. And of course that's not the case. So, you know, and my views on this are evolving, because initially I was of the opinion, you know, if it's misinformation, then yeah, boot them off the platform. You're not entitled to use their private platform. But then sort of thinking about it, it's, well, who's going to be the arbiter of what's true and what's not true? And, you know, do I trust Twitter? Do I trust Instagram? Do I trust Mark Zuckerberg? Do I trust maybe Elon Musk, who's going to be like, you know, and I the answer to all of those is no. So yeah, censorship and like internet regulation, I think we have to be so careful about that. You know, because the shoe will fit on the other foot just as well. And that, you know, I think that that's dangerous. But yeah, I like it's totally just a cluster, and, you know, there isn't going to be an easy solution. And what I've tried to do is counter bad information with better information, right? Or better ideas. And that only works to a certain extent, because, you know, confirmation bias, people sort of get rooted and attached to their opinions, and then it becomes a point of pride, and you're not even responsive to contradicting information. So human psychology is really working against us.
Yes. Yeah, a lot of human nature, even what we were talking about earlier with sort of the struggles and the problems with the police, a lot of that is, some of that I think is not just police behavior, it's kind of human behavior, in the sense of like when we're talking about using discretion and feeling more comfortable with one set of protesters than another. They are ugly sides of human nature, but a lot of it is, some of it is human nature, I think. Now to take a totally different path, this is maybe the most head-scratching thing when I was trying to prepare for this, of this issue you have with the Canadian Anti-Hate Network. I don't really know the whole story of it, so maybe you can explain, but it seems like you don't have the greatest relationship with the Canadian Anti-Hate Network.
I don't, and it's really unfortunate, because I would think that we're working towards similar goals, and, you know, have tried to correspond privately with the organization for some time. Where a rift sort of emerged was with my attempt to interview Chris Sky. And that was portrayed as platforming him. I disagreed. In any event, I wasn't planning to debate his ideas. And he has a much larger audience than I do. So I didn't see myself as platforming him. And there was opposition to that event that I didn't anticipate manifesting in a real and physical sense. People showed up to blockade the entrance to the venue. I canceled the show. Nobody dispersed. And this crowd that, you know, called themselves counter protesters, but there was no protest to counter in the first place. I feel that they did a disservice by creating a situation where confrontation was going to happen and then acting surprised when that's exactly what transpired. You know, and we can talk for days about blockades and, you know, obviously there was the convoy blockade in Ottawa just now that wasn't received very favorably, but public opinion might be different about Indigenous land defenders holding a blockade. So I think that context absolutely matters. And the bottom line, I feel, is that if you don't have a lawful right to prevent someone's mobility or access, and the end result of that was stifled political expression, I see that as a net negative. And I was really lambasted for having that opinion. And the way the Canadian Anti-Hate Network operates, there are some reporters who put their names on bylines. And it's my understanding that there are a lot of affiliates or people who are associated with the network who may or may not be getting paid. So it's not necessarily monetary. It may be strictly ideological, but who operate as nameless, faceless accounts and with a degree of impunity almost. And I've had all sorts of defamatory things said about me for the past 9 months. It's been ongoing. So this clique associated with the organization has it out for me. And, you know, I don't appreciate the notion of a primarily white-led organization trying to dictate how I confront racism or right-wing extremism. You know, I think that there's room for different approaches, and like it really, we should be able to stay in our own lanes. And you know, unfortunately, that is not the position that the organization took. And so, you know, looking further at it, I realize that I'm not the only person with such experiences. And, you know, the solution that seems to be offered by the Canadian Anti-Hate Network is support for bills or legislation or approaches that ultimately favor censorship. And I that doesn't sit right with me. I am a strong believer in civil liberties. And while I am not one to say that we should be giving, for example, equal airtime to a Holocaust denier and let's engage seriously with their views, I don't think that suppressing, you know, within the confines of hate speech, and there are kind of laws that set parameters on this. But overall, I don't think I favor censorship as an approach. And so that was an ideological difference. You know, there's this assumed consensus about platforming, like an orthodoxy almost, that I've never ascribed to. So it's not really clear why it was being imposed and sort of who gives who the right to enforce that. But for the most part, you know, I've continued by just doing my thing. And, you know, obviously that's where I'm at right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's quite a dilemma with people that you would think, yes, think similarly to you and be on the same side, this dilemma and how to react or how to take in what has been happening. And there's the quick answer is always some sort of shutdown or heavy-handed police movements or censorship, like you're saying. And that's maybe some of them are in a short-term way kind of effective, but it's not going to even come close to getting rid of any root causes of the challenges we face. And it's just actually anything going to extrapolate or increase the problems we're having. So now returning, it would be quite insulting, I think, to call you a political pundit. So I'm not adding that view, but I do have to add this in. Since, yes, I do have to come a bit back to the Ford family, although I must say, I do love, I know you said you're not the one drawing them, but I do love the portraits of Brian Lilly, a true Charlton, if there ever was one. He not enough talked about either, so I'm glad you show him quite a bit in those cartoons. Aren't we just in the state in Ontario, like, where, I don't know, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but the opposition to politically to Doug Ford is quite haphazard at best. And it's really just whether he ended this mass mandate or not, I agree it helped him quite a bit, but this is going to be a walkthrough for him in June anyway, especially the same electoral system and parliamentary system. So
disheartening. Yes,
I'm not asking you to give me exact seat counts or anything, but to be fair to you, maybe not Ottawa, but when you're in Eastern Ontario, minus maybe the city area of Peterborough, but basically anywhere from like the eastern edge of the GTA all the way out to Ottawa, most of that is like maybe minus Alberta and Saskatchewan, the thickest blue you could have.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, there really is no opposition much. Yeah. So I don't know. You can tell me if I'm wrong, if you really think that there's a chance for the NDP or Liberals to gain form in this election upcoming. But
I think short of some sort of, you know, political alliance between the Liberals and the NDPs, which, you know, seems less and less likely by the day, the reality is we're going to have split votes. And I think, you know, I can't speak to all the specific candidates, but I believe that there is a prevailing sense that, you know, the conservative candidate is somehow, you know, all of these ideals that they portray themselves as having, right? Like the fiscal responsibility, you know, the bootstrap mentality, like, you know, the, we're not for the big cities, we're for kind of the workers, and you know, all of that is just messaging. I don't know that any of it's really borne out by their policies. But short of there being candidates who are clearly responsive to local issues and really doing that on the ground work, you know, it's hard to shift people's mentality. And I do fear that we're going to end up kind of in a similar situation. And just, I am dismayed by the opposition. You know, I can't imagine sort of handing it on a more silver platter, like all of the scandals, all of the blunders, all of the mishaps. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, there's so much to work with, and yet they are flailing. And, you know, it's very frustrating. And I think the media plays a part in this as well, as far as holding the premier to account and keeping his feet to the fire. And, you know, I'm not really convinced that the press conferences we see are really allowing sort of for that media access or allowing people to ask the tough questions. And it becomes a matter of access to the premier, and you're compromising, you know, the
the tough questions that need to be put to him. And there's not really any consistency in storytelling. So we have such a fast news cycle that people get distracted, they forget. And, you know, the horrors of LTC, for example, like that's something that, yes, was not repaired under the Liberals, but the genesis of that privatization was, you know, a conservative government. Mike Harris sits, you know, on the board of Chartwells. He received the Order of Ontario, and like there was no real solution. We didn't even have, you know, Minister Fullerton. She didn't even apologize for what was going on. And somehow that's not hammered in to the electorate or to the sort of the news audience. So yeah, like just very depressing state of affairs.
Yeah, it is. I would argue, even though when COVID first occurred, it really threw off Doug with his buck a beer plans and his shiny smile that he had in the debates with Kathleen Wynne from the previous election. It ended up really helping him because he really had control of us with those daily, you know, news that I admit I was watching because at that time I was a teacher. So, you know, are we, is school ending? Is school going to be on? Is it ending? You know, that kind of thing. He had us totally looped in for both 2020 and 21 of that. And there really was no, while some of the reporters may have asked really tough and vital questions, I think there were few, you know, it was mostly, of course, the Toronto Sun had the first question. And more importantly, you didn't really ever hear the opposition's voice very much in this, or they wasn't given much coverage, or maybe they didn't have much to say, or both. So now, from April 9th, what you've just done this past weekend at Peter's Burgers, do you have any sort of major takeaways or things you learned from that experience? I mean, I've seen various clips of it, but I just don't know if you really... It wasn't overly large, but still a solid.
Oh, there was probably about like 125, 150 people.
Oh, okay.
I think a fair number came from out of town. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's going to be probably a challenge for the restaurant, in the sense that they're going to need local support to stay afloat and continue to thrive. And whether that support is forthcoming or not, that remains to be seen. As far as major takeaways, you know, they kept calling it a grand reopening, but there wasn't much to distinguish it from sort of the majority of protests or rallies that I have attended. I did show up, full disclosure, in, you know, a makeshift hazmat suit. Mm-hmm. And that was because I was invited to come in costume. They had actually offered me $100 to dress up as a burger and dance in front of the restaurant. And I could not find a burger suit. And I don't think the hazmat suit was very well received.
No, they was something a little more solid and beefier, perhaps. I don't know. Maybe. I found it kind of unfortunate because it's kind of getting in the, you know, coming from a privileged point of view, they're kind of like getting in the way of where I want to eat across the street. I don't know if you know, if you've seen that. It's a place called Shafiq's. It's quite good.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yes. They just sort of like go into their property sometimes and they're just always around there and you're, you know,
I think he might actually be their landlord. So he is, I think he is in a tough spot.
Yes. He is in a tough spot. Yes. He's got a BMW, but he is in a bit of a tough spot that way. Yes. So I guess what you're saying is often sometimes these things that can seem kind of local are really more of an out of town presence, not just in Peterborough, but a lot of other places.
Yeah, there's, you know, one thing I will say is that there's an incredible amount of energy that people who are part of this movement, you know, put into their efforts and endeavors. And I can't help but wonder if that was just redirected just a tiny bit into, you know, anything productive, what a game changer that could be. And so that's, I hold out that hope, that, you know, something will, there's, I think, a sense, a genuine sense among many of the participants that they are doing something of importance, and, you know, that this is a stand for freedom. And I do my best to redirect to issues that, you know, are actually pressing and are threatening our quality of life, our ability to be free, and just aren't as hot topic, I guess. So yes, out of town presence, like, that's common. Even the weekly Toronto marches, you know, there are some people who are living downtown, but a lot of people come from the suburbs, even as far as Stratford. So, you know, there's congregating, and again, resources and energy that's put into this, that just a shame.
Right. And do you see some relation between Peter's Burgers and what happened at the infamous Adamson's barbecue?
There was a shout out to Adam Skelly, okay, as, you know, the original rebel restaurateur. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, and this is maybe me putting my cynical hat on a little bit, that in choosing to become the face of the movement, there is, you know, calculated choice being made about promotion, notoriety, sort of acceptance within a community, etc. Mm-hmm. So I that's always in the back of my mind. And for Adam Skelly, he was able to fundraise quite a bit, you know, upwards of $350,000 on GoFundMe. Some or a lot of which was spent on legal fees, and sort of fines and court costs, etc. But he's since relocated to Alberta. So, you know, is there kind of a grand scheme? Maybe, maybe not. You know, is this a business that was thriving pre-pandemic? I think it was a relatively new business, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, there's a lot of restaurants that got hard hit. And I don't know sort of whether taking a stand on this, you know, what is the real motivation? You would know better than me, but I get the sense that previously I had attended a rally in Peterborough to see Chris Skye, actually. Mm-hmm. And that was happening at like the city hall. Yeah. And now it seems that the sort of the point of congregating is Peter Burgers. So, you know, I find that interesting as well.
Yeah, I think that is mainly because, similar to Adamson, he kind of came out to the owner of Peter's Burgers, like, you know, came out publicly and said he would not be following the mandates, the ones that were issued in 2021. And that kind of, I think, started that ball rolling. Mm-hmm. And there were some, I know for a fact, there were some religious groups that he got the backing of, and it went from there. Last part, her talk about her experience last July and her attempt to interview Chris Skye last July in Toronto, where there were some outside interveners that did not think that was appropriate and that should not occur. Now, that was a traumatic experience for her, in her own words. Plus, I will
give some philosophical jingle jam questions that don't really make any sense to any listener. And here we go with our last part.
So the venue was actually going to be, I rent an office at the Chinatown Center, mm-hmm. which is a mall downtown Toronto. And I also have a store there. And the store primarily is where I operate. In 2020, we operated outdoor comedy shows. So this was meant to be kind of a continuation of that. And, you know, some of the feedback I got is, well, why would you choose the Chinatown community? This is literally my home. I live here. I work here. This is the community that I have and know. And that particular sort of Karima Rules the Night, that hasn't gotten off the ground. It was frankly a bit traumatic what happened on July 10th. And I had to take some time to regroup and kind of figure out what I was doing and where things would go from there. So, you know, I'm looking at what to do this year. If anything, it might be reverting back to less controversial comedy shows. You know, the show itself was, you know, billed as Chris Guy, the main event. But that main event would have been 15 minutes out of a 2 or 3 hour program.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating with, I hope that works out for you, but it's quite fascinating how these days comedy seems to be something that has such a verbatim against it for may sometimes be justifiable reasons, but I don't know. When I grew up, you know, there were people like George Carlin, Richard Pryor, even Eddie Murphy. You know, you shouldn't be letting your 7-year-old listen to it, but it wasn't really ever, there was no political kind of thing that came out of it. Even if, at least with Carlin and Pryor, there definitely were political messages in there. But these days it seems like, I don't know whether you're, there's so many like now sort of comedians have had reactions against them. I know sometimes justifiably so, but like whether you're Louis C.K. or Dave Chappelle or whoever, it just seems to be kind of that, even to a point, maybe Jon Stewart, it seems to be that ticket that it's maybe the one way of like really sort of bringing an audience together on a bigger scale and being able to be in more of a state of both understanding and kind of a more relaxed kind of way of seeing the bigger picture. But it just seems like we have to be resorting to these extreme reactions every time. I don't know. That seems to be the problem with comedy. I think comedy is a great way of communicating things, but it also faces that same time it's not hard to be given sort of a big kind of negative reaction on either side of like either the people you supposedly are making fun of or the people that you're even giving space to in the beginning that you've experienced. I don't know if you have any like further thoughts on that.
No, I mean, yeah, it's almost like a double-edged sword where you get negative reactions on both sides. And you know, there's also just, I think a laser focus almost on, I'm trying to think how to articulate this because for me, comedy, right, it's not about punching down. It should be about punching up. And so I think that there's valid criticism where someone is doing the opposite. And, you know, we are operating in a space where celebrity and privilege, those are all sort of, they give people power, but that power is almost being reclaimed through social media and then turned on its head, right? And so anyone can then sort of fall to that. And I'm not sure that I'm making a whole lot of sense here, but I think comedy is a very useful tool, and there are people who staunchly disagree and who say that there are things that shouldn't be joked about, and that, you know, it's inappropriate, it minimizes it, and I don't know, maybe there are ways, there's obviously ways to be tasteful, but nothing is going to be universally appealing. And, you know, I don't think we should strive to be universally appealing, because that's just bland. So that's what it is. It does engender very strong responses. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And I wasn't even thinking of the slap, and I don't want to talk about that issue either, but yes, there's things of that. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what you're saying back further just a minute or two ago about like how you found the people on April 9th at Petersburger's like really emotionally engaged and really, you know, into this, whether they're from out of town or not. And if only their like, feelings and emotions could be directed into another direction, because I don't know, maybe you can comment on this, but I guess I'm getting this a bit from like on a deeper scale, someone like late Mark Fisher, where he basically said we're kind of locked into this late capitalism. We can't really see our way out of it. Like, you mm-hmm. know, well, you know, we're living less, we're earning less than our parents mm-hmm. were before us. We don't have any clear political allies. We just have a social media that's like drumming us up. But we don't really see any other way out of it. You know, they really, so to make it about what was happening in Canada, like it's just, you know, all I need to go back is like not face any inconveniences when I go shopping, or I just want to be able to do my work and not have any pay cuts or be worried about losing my job. And it's just about going back to the status quo. It's mm-hmm. not about like there being an alternative mm-hmm. Route in the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very myopic. And, you know, there's like an opportunity here to think about things differently and do things differently. And I think that kind of our political apparatus is working really hard against that. And people, that takes work and it's messy. And it's a lot easier to just sort of think back and say, well, you know, I was happier then, so let's go back to that. But I think the pre-pandemic normal wasn't working for everyone. And you know, those kind of gaps were wedged even deeper as a result of COVID. So it takes a mindset change, and you know, that is like not something that's easy to come by.
Mm-hmm. So on my last point here, I was getting this from when someone was talking about the late Austrian novelist Thomas Bernhard, but basically I don't really see how human beings can do this, but to a certain point, if you're going to have to, I hope you don't, but if you're going to ever have any incident like what happened last July with Chris Sky, or if you're still going to be facing constant assaults and attacks on your social media, does there come a point where you just have to, if you're going to feel a personal sense of freedom, it's more comes from not caring what other people think about you? Is there anything valid to that?
Oh, totally. That was probably the big takeaway from last year. And especially seeing people who I thought were friends or allies, how quickly opinions can turn. And realizing that, in fact, I can't take that personally, and I can't be vested in people's approval or disapproval. And really centering what I do on my values. And is this furthering my values? Is it in line with kind of what I think is valid and good and ethical and moral? And If it's not, then recalibrating. And if it is, then the feedback is going to be, you know, what it is. I can't control that. You know, there's no sort of magical sway that I can have on people. And, you know, that has been freeing in a sense. And, you know, I've had this conversation with Dean Blundell, actually, kind of who has overcome his own... These dogs, I swear, I'm just going to sell them. yeah, I've had this conversation with Dean Blundell, who has been really kind of helpful in helping me figure out that frame of mind. And it's easier said than done, because, you know, the natural instinct is to want to be responsive to feedback. And it's just not possible when it's social media and it's thousands of unsolicited sort of opinions, and some of which may not even be real people. So, you know, figuring out kind of who is my trusted circle, and really relying on them to keep me on track. And I'll say it again, sort of centering things on my values.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I hardly addressed, like I said, all kind of maybe 10, 12 parts of different things you're involved with. I don't know how you do all of it, really. We didn't address your practice as a lawyer. I know you've done a lot of great things in the past for housing and things like that. But still, quite a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much for the invite. I've learned
quite a bit. When I put this together, I'll send you a copy anyway.
I appreciate it. Thank you. And I really enjoyed this chat. And if you ever need me again, if things develop in Peterborough, I will be happy
I'll make sure you're invited. Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Well, that was one of my most pleasurable experiences in broadcasting. Perhaps the most of, you know, only 14 episodes, but it was definitely, you know, so many issues involved of someone who's so actively in them. It's not just sitting back in an armchair, and I have to applaud her for that, being out there. So, Corner of Hunter and George, hopefully you'll hear from me again soon. We're on Apple and Spotify. You can look for me on Twitter on @ElectricCityBang. Name after my radio show. And I'll see you again soon. And let's hear some, you know, whether you like it or not, this occurred. Let's hear the sounds of Peter's Burgers as we end today. See you next time.
What's going on, Peterborough? I don't think they can hear Canadians yet! They said I'm not really going to do that to Roy and Nicole, but yeah, we can never really get too quiet. You know what I mean? Like, enough's enough. We'll crowdfund for it right now and pay it. Or you can add it to my collection that I'll never pay. There's a lot.